This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
Thank you, Shannon. Here's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and MSU Alumni Association Executive Director Scott Westerman with the Director of MSU's Facility for Rare Isotope Beams, Thomas Glassmacher.
If you've been in the neighborhood of the Wharton Center recently, you've probably seen a lot of construction going on. The Facility for Rare Isotope Beams, something we MSU folk call FRIB, is sprouting up out of the frozen East Lansing tundra as we speak, leading the charge for what will be one of the defining achievements for MSU in the new millennium is Dr. Thomas Glassmacher. He joined our National Superconducting Cyclotron Laboratory in 1992. After earning a PhD in low-energy spectrum nuclear physics from Florida State, he is now the university distinguished professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy and the leader of the FRIB project. Explain FRIB in non-technical language. What is it?
Okay. So it's a particle accelerator where we can speed up any atoms of any element between from hydrogen to uranium to half the speed of light. So we take them at rest, we remove some electrons, and then they're positively charged, and we always hold a negative potential in front of them, and they speed up, and they speed up, and they speed up. And when they have the speed of light, we smash them onto something. And when we smash them onto something, they break into other atoms that have fewer protons and fewer neutrons, and we select out the ones the scientists want. The structure of FRIB is a national user facility where the best in the nation write proposals for beam time. If they promise to publish the research, they don't have to pay. And a scientific advisory committee selects the proposals on scientific merit. But it's our job to facilitate the scientists' discoveries. We give them the tool. They make the discoveries. And the tool is rare isotopes that are combinations of protons and neutrons that used to exist on Earth, but they have long since decayed. They continue to be made in the stars, but we can't get them from the stars. So we make them here for a split second. They do their experiments, and they gain insight, and they gain knowledge for mankind, and then they publish it.
Why is that so important?
There's many arguments. We can talk about the high-level argument is that the economic competitiveness of the nation hinges on scientific discovery. We can't point to each particular experiment how that enhances competitiveness, but as a whole, advancing science serves the nation. In each particular subdiscipline, be it astrophysics, those folks want to figure out how were the elements made? Why is that gold in your gold watch on Earth? They're going to answer that question. There's the people in nuclear physics. They want to figure out what's holding atomic nuclei together. We're all made of them, yet we don't have a predictive theory which numbers of protons and neutrons you can combine. The electromagnetic force is well understood. Gravitation is relatively well understood. The nuclear force is not well understood. So there are many arguments. There's an economic argument, a national interest argument, and then, of course, for the scientists in each discipline, they have great arguments why it's extremely interesting to study what they're doing.
You know, when we hear the word nuclear, we always go to the negative aspect. How do you stop people from being afraid of the positive, of the possible dangerous consequences of
their knowledge? So that's right. So first I want to make the point, this is not a reactor. When you turn FRIB off, most of the radiation, no more radiation is made. It's not a self-sustaining process. It stops. It's similar to the, if you go to cancer treatment, you get electron beams. When it turns off, it turns off. But it's nuclei and not electrons. There is some residual radiation, and we're managing that responsibly. We've managed radiation on campus responsibly for 40, 50 years. We've had a license from the government under the Atomic Energy Commission, which is the predecessor to the Department of Energy, for 40 to 50 years. I forgot how long. And part of that responsible management is the president's covenant with the community, limiting by design all emissions to 10% of the regulatorily allowed limit. So if the government says you can get 100 milligram, which is the unit per year, we say no more than 10 if you were to sit on FRIB for 8,000 hours, which is not comfortable. So by design,
you think about it as an extraordinary time commitment to be able to be to have at risk this sort of lower limit.
And that, how does that compare to what a nurse would get in a typical X-ray room?
Oh, nurses get, I mean, most, I've been at the lab for 20-something years, and so most people, it's much less than what a nurse at a dentist's office gets. But that's what we do. We're citizens on this campus, we're citizens in this community, we're responsible. I mean, we live here, we don't want to mess the place up. And we want to.
So, but I think part of the what Tomas says is we put on the, in this competition, and it, because there's most people understand that there's radiation in that sense all around you, that machines give it off, nurses are exposed to it in the normal course, dentist assistants, all those kinds of things. So it's not zero in anybody's life. Mm-hmm. So, and that's why these things are calculated to be sure that in any given point or over a lifetime, you really understand that there may be effects of all of this. And the campus has gave FRIB the charge of not simply meeting what, let's say, a user facility would have at another place, but to be sort of 10 times better than that. Because that way you always have a margin for error that is significant, that even when you make a mistake, you're well below the tolerances for danger. But it put onto the laboratory an enormous design challenge to be able to do that. The other thing you need to sort of understand about FRIB, but I think that people don't understand, is that this is not something you sort of take off the shelf. The accelerator as a concept is relatively well known, but in order to get these heavier atoms going at this faster speed, this half the speed of light, requires, you know, and to get these negative incentives around the process requires very sophisticated and really, in many ways, untested and unknown science. And so part of this process up through the time we were awarded the initial opportunity to move forward in this and given sort of the project as a way of proving ourselves, not the project as a defined project in DOE, was we had to show people that we had the ingenuity in a scientific sense, the ingenuity in a manufacturing engineering sense, the ingenuity in a fiscal sense to be able to make things that have not been made before and put them in arrays that will permit us to accelerate as no one has ever have these heavy ions in order to do that. Then you have to prove to people that you know how to stop them. Which is, if you think about stopping something at half the speed of light, it's not a simple process. And sort of Thomas sort of ran that off, sort of off the top of his head. But it's not a simple thing to do. And so they've had to figure that out. They've had to figure out how, when you stop it, you know what you have. Okay. So, again, not a simple or straightforward question. And then once you think you know what you have, you've got to sort it out to find the one small part of it that you want to work with in this, you know, instant that it's available to you to really understand all of these issues. And so it is both a big science problem in the sense of the theory that goes with this, the understanding of the universe, and potentially medical applications, potentially ways of testing new materials. There are lots of very practical applications that will come down the road, just like there was in space study. But at the same time, there's all this very complicated stuff that isn't the off-the-shelf thing. And so at each stage from when we were given the opportunity to say we're the only, the project was, quote, awarded, to now, the lab has gone through all of these intensive reviews. I don't know how many we've gone through.
Well, it's over 100 by now, but it's a lot of them.
That in each part of it, so it's the accelerator, it's the detection system, it's the engineering, it's the safety systems. All of these reviewed by external people over and over again to make sure that we're refining the ideas, that we can actually build the cryo modules. You know, all this thing will actually work in the way that it's planned. So now we're in the position where if you go over there, they've built some of these things, and they've proven that they can build them and they'll work in isolation. So now we have the opportunity to dig the hole because the accelerator is underground. One of the best insulations for radiation is dirt. Okay, and so it'll be under lots of dirt and cement. But we have to still start that process. And in some ways, the civil construction, while getting the most attention now, is probably the simplest part of the project that we have to do.
It's what people see.
It's what people see, but it's also the simplest part, and we get people to work. It's really then once the hole is dug and the building is done, it's how all these parts fit together that really make this work. And part of the timeline of the project is not so much the construction, which is really about what, two years.
Yeah, it's 2.5 years till we can move into the building. You know, President Simon touches on an important point. You can't buy this stuff off the shelf. So you need to build a team that's up to the challenge of creating something anew. And that we need to have the right mindset, but we can't be careless and have a lot of risk. So to mitigate the risk, we need to be extremely transparent, and we bring people in who have built other things that were new. And they share their experiences, and we need to listen to their experiences. We take their context away, and we think about the lessons they learned. And then we apply those lessons to our context because their situation was different, and their situation is an MSU. And so building this team, bringing them together, and focusing them on the task, that's what we've done. And at the same time, I was thinking there's hundreds of people on campus who have helped EFRIP. This is not just the EFRIP team. This is this campus. This is this MSU community and this state who make this happen. We are fortunate there is a lot of manufacturing still in Michigan. So we spend right now over 2/3 of the EFRIP money is spent in the state because we can find suppliers here who can make the stuff for us. Now, they've never made a cryo module, but they're doing it now. And so if we were someplace else, it would be much more difficult.
It's really about then looking for this to be a Michigan project because Michigan has supported us so well. And they've been working with these manufacturers to think about how they can turn some of what they're doing, because we have great talent in Michigan, to making things that are different. But the reason you attract people is a big idea In the world of nuclear physics, this is it. This is the pinnacle of being at a place. But it's also a place you want to be at. Okay? Because these are people that can go anywhere and do nuclear physics. So you have to. This has to be not just a big idea or something that will be doable. Because when people came 2 years ago, it was still questionable whether we would get all the funding because we had to go through all of these hoops and all these reviews in order to get to this stage. But they wanted to be part of something special.
Right.
And that's what you have to do if you're going to recruit, the world's best. They have to feel like they want to be part of something special, and their individual contribution makes a difference. It's not much different, if you think about it, than how you recruit people to great teams anywhere. And Tomas and his group have done a great job of recruiting and retaining people. And one of the concerns that DOE had in the beginning about us doing it as opposed to a national laboratory was whether or not we could recruit and retain talent.
That's really the key. You need to put the right people in the right spot. And like President Simon says, they can go anywhere, but they want to be here. They're attracted by the idea. They come to MSU. Many of them have met with the president. She's our greatest recruiter because the fact that the president of the institution stands behind this project tells them that this is serious, especially at a time when funding was uncertain. So the professionals want to be here. And then you need to make their family believe that Lansing is a good place to live. And that's complicated too, because they're coming from California, they're coming from the East Coast. And what we learned is if you bring them to Michigan, if you bring them to East Lansing, they love it here. But the preconceived notion out there may not lend itself to them coming by themselves. So we're doing the two-step. We bring the person we want, and then if we like them, we invite their family, the whole family. And then we show them Lansing, and they can see themselves live here and prosper. And then the hiring is easy. So it's the idea and then the family. We are authentic here. There isn't a lot of fake stuff. And we have a team that can deliver. And it's that team that delivers which makes, you know, convinces DOE that we can execute. The idea is great and we can execute. And that's the whole spectrum. And that's the interesting part. You get these type A personalities who really driven, really want to do their stuff, but they subordinate themselves under the greater good. They're optimized for the project. They're optimized for MSU. They're committed to MSU. And they understand your leadership, that you're committed to us. And that's kind of a, you know, that's as good as it gets. And, you know, the science is complicated and we'll succeed in it. But we will also go down routes that don't work. But we know that as a team we can make this work. We don't know exactly how we're going to make it work in all the details yet, but we have a pretty good idea. And overcoming these challenges as they arise with the power and the belief and the knowledge that we can do it, that's what makes us powerful. And at the same time, we got to stay humble so that we're able to learn from those wiser people who've done similar other things before. Because if we become too self-confident, we will fail.
You know, we live in a world where we celebrate video games and pro athletes. How do you inspire parents to teach their kids a love of science?
I don't know, but I know, you know, MSU holds the state finals for Science Olympiad. When I came to campus, they used to be at Grand Valley, and they moved over here in the 90s sometime. And, you know, that's one of the things. I mean, science is neat. It's relevant and it's complicated. And a lot of folks get scared away by complicated. But if you break it into pieces, it's still neat and beautiful and self-consistent. And it's powerful because you can predict things. You have predictive abilities.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
That was Thomas Glassmacher, Project Director for MSU's Facility for Rare Isotope Beams, talking with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and MSU Alumni Association Executive Director Scott Westerman. There's more online at frib.msu.edu. And to hear an extended version of this conversation, please visit spartanpodcast.com. Up next, what's new at Consumers Energy?
You're listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Whether you're moving across town or across the country, relocating to a new job or a new city is always a challenge. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, wherever you go, you'll have an instant circle of friends on hand to help you get settled and get connected. With more than 100 clubs and affiliates around the world, there's a Spartan in just about every city. And as an MSU Alumni Association member, you'll quickly feel right at home. Wherever you go, community, connections, careers, and class, four great reasons to visit alumni.msu.edu today to activate your membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. That's alumni.msu.edu, the Michigan State University Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk to folks from Consumers Energy. And this week we have Patty Poppy, who is the Vice President for Customer Experience, Rates, and Regulation. And Patty, like myself, is also the very proud owner of a Chevy Volt. Patty, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me, Kirk. I love my Chevy Volt. And here's a fun fact about the Chevy Volt. My 16-year-old daughter plays the harp, and believe it or not, the harp fits in the Chevy Volt. So not only can you power it with electricity, you can carry large musical instruments.
Well, like yourself, I don't carry the musical instruments given my monotone when it comes to music, but I do love my Chevy Volt. But Consumers Energy provided me with a 240 charger in my garage that cost me nothing, and I've been extremely pleased with that program, and I'm sure you folks are as well.
We are, and that program is still available. So if customers have recently purchased a new Volt and are in the Consumers Energy territory, we would love to outfit your garage with that fast charging station.
Well, as long as we're talking about the Chevy Volt and alternative energy and things of that nature, talk a little bit about some of your balanced energy portfolio, Patty.
Well, Consumers Energy for 126 years has provided energy to the people in Michigan, and certainly we look for a balanced set of solutions. So as demand for energy increases, we want to make sure that we're delivering clean energy for the citizens of Michigan. And the good news is the air is cleaner than it has been in 50 years here in Michigan. We've done a ton of work to reduce the emissions at our power plants, and in fact, we're continuing to do more. By 2017, we will, in fact, retire 7 more coal-fueled power plants, and we are replacing it with natural gas as an alternative, as well as our renewable energy portfolio. We have 2 wind farms, one up in Ludington and a new one under construction also in Michigan. So we think there's a balanced solution to providing energy to the citizens of Michigan.
You know, we'll come back to the coal in a moment, but that balanced portfolio, and I like to ask guests this question, and it's kind of a tough one, but as you look 20, 30, 40 years down the road, you're going to see a balance. But will that balance shift a bit? Will there be more renewables, less coal, more natural gas? I mean, put on your forecaster hat for a moment, Patty. What is it going to look like?
I would say for the long term, natural gas will play a stronger role. You know, this shale revolution that we've had in the United States and the access to abundant natural gas, it is a great alternative fuel to coal. And I think that the penetration of within the balance will be much more significantly biased to natural gas because it's a great base load fuel. One thing to keep in mind about renewables until now, and the technology will continue to evolve, but right now, a wind farm will not fuel a steel plant. A wind farm will not fuel a GM assembly line. You know, those high-load, high-demand businesses, which are part of the heartbeat of Michigan, require good base-load generation. And so natural gas and coal will continue to play a critical part in providing base-load. Now, as battery technology improves, as renewable technologies evolve, we can only begin to imagine how they might evolve. Our job at Consumers Energy is to build a long-term solution for providing the energy that customers want when they want it and how they want it. So we really work hard to make sure that that balance is provided for the long term. For 126 years we've been here in Michigan. We want to be here for another 126 years. Our job is to think long term, and so we've got some really smart people who work on long-term power supply plans. And you don't just decide on a dime that we're going to have a plant tomorrow. It takes years to site, permit, build, engineer a new power plant. So we need to be thinking long term, and that's why the balance is so important.
Talked about you're retiring some coal-fired plants at Consumers. A lot of our listeners out there, you know, the coal issue is one that often comes to top of mind. You can have coal-fired plants and still have clean air. Is that correct?
As I mentioned, the air is cleaner than it has been in 50 years. Our nitrogen oxide levels are down 78%. Our emissions for SO2 are down another 84% since 2007. We continue to reduce our emissions and absolutely make sure that we're providing clean air. So you can have, the coal is what the coal is. It comes out of the ground as it comes out of the ground. And so people talk about clean coal. What it really is about clean power. And you can have clean power. We're proving it. We're doing it. And we continue to deliver clean air for the citizens of Michigan.
You're doing so much on the energy generation side, but let's not forget about the other side of the coin, and that's energy conservation. I know Consumers have some wonderful programs and incentives for energy conservation, and let's talk about those for a moment.
Well, we definitely have a suite of energy efficiency programs, both for natural gas and electricity. Some people ask me, why would an energy company want their customers to use less of their product? And it's actually not a very hard question. We know that, again, in that long-term view of providing energy, that part of the portfolio, part of that balance, is helping customers use less and waste less. We want less energy waste. And so the cheapest energy is the energy you don't use. And as energy demand continues to grow, if we can help people use less, then we have to build less. And so all of us get to spend less because we pay energy bills too. We're customers and employees, and we want to make sure that we're providing the lowest cost, reliable, cleanest energy for the people of Michigan.
My guest is Patty Poppe. She's the Vice President for Customer Experience, Rates, and Regulation for Consumers Energy. Patty, let's come back to energy conservation here just for a second. What are some things that people can do, people who are listening to this interview, can do in their homes to reduce to conserve energy and reduce the amount of energy that they're consuming?
Well, your most powerful energy efficiency tool is your thermostat. A big load comes from your furnace, heat in the winter, and air conditioning in the summer. So you turn that thermostat down 1 degree, and you'll save 3% on your energy bill. So you imagine turning it down 3 degrees, you've saved almost 10% on your energy bill. That's an easy change to make. You know, believe it or not, at my house, my husband runs a tight ship. We keep our thermostat set at 66 degrees, you know, during the winter, and we turn it down to 55 when we're not at home or at night. We have saved by just managing the thermostat and then doing some simple insulation. We cut our energy bills at our home by a third by just doing the low-cost, no-cost energy savings. If you go to the consumersenergy.com website, you'll find ways to save and energy efficiency tips, and we have hundreds of tips of ways to save.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm a Consumers Energy customer, so I should know this, but don't you provide energy audits for people who really want to take a holistic look at their homes or their businesses?
We sure do. It's a great program. Again, you can access that through our website on consumersenergy.com. We have a home energy assessment. A professional will come to your home and give you advice about where you can save. And then you can even do a more comprehensive, what's called a blower door test, where they actually seal up your house and test and can show you with both photographs and air seal tests where your air leakage and energy leakage really is happening in your home, and so you can know what to fix. Here's an interesting quick fact for you. If you have an eighth of an inch gap around your front door, just around the perimeter of the front door, that's the same thing as having a softball-sized hole in the middle of your door. Now, you would fix a softball-sized hole in the middle of your door. So go ahead and fix that weather stripping. It's cheap. You can do a quick weather strip job. You can get the weather stripping at your local hardware store. Or even if you feel cool air this time of year, you'll notice, feel the cool air around windows, you can do simple weather stripping kits from the hardware store, the window seal kits that are just basically plastic with tape around the window. They're low cost. They really do make a difference, and you can save money and energy by taking some simple steps.
Well, I got to tell you, Patty, I thought I had energy-efficient doors until we've had this this frigid weather of late. And as I walk by the doors now, believe me, I notice. So that's excellent advice. And probably for even people who have relatively new homes, ought to check out those doors and windows.
And check out your insulation. A lot of new home construction, builders don't always, unless really demanded by their homeowner, builders often don't insulate properly. And so you really can get a good improvement on your energy bills by just doing some simple blow-in insulation up in the attic. But, of course, if our home energy assessors come to your house and do the review, they'll give you all those tips. And then the easy tips are on our website, low-cost, no-cost things you can do on your own at home.
One question that my friends in agriculture would say I was remiss if I didn't ask you. The folks in ag, there are some parts of the state where there have been some issues with agricultural producers having a sufficient amount of energy. I don't know if it's a consumer's issue or one of the competitors, but are there some things going on in terms of increasing energy supplies in some of our more rural areas in the state of Michigan?
I think the issue you're referencing, I'm going to guess, is the access to propane. And there have been some propane shortages, particularly in the Upper Peninsula, but also that's starting to trickle into the Lower Peninsula. And propane, a lot of agriculture, large commercial farmers or even large family farmers will use grain dryers that use propane. And so we're actually working on a program where we can convert them to natural gas because there's such abundant supply. Here in Michigan, we have the third largest storage fields in the nation for natural gas. We have no risk of running out of natural gas here in Michigan because of those storage fields and our incredibly intelligent purchasing team who year-round are planning and making sure that those storage fields are well-stocked with the natural gas that customers demand. And so we're working with the legislature, actually, to look at some new laws to enable us to provide more natural gas to customers, do more customer attachments. We're looking at 2,500 customers converting from propane to gas this year, and we actually have a waiting list. And so we're working on figuring out the best way to enable customers to switch.
You know, I think, and correct me, I'd be interested in your opinion, the governor and his people are taking a very strategic look at more natural gas extraction. University of Michigan is doing a comprehensive study on hydraulic fracturing and its impact on Michigan. Michigan has had a very good environmental record when it comes to extracting natural gas historically. The governor and his people want to make sure that continues. I'm sure Consumers does as well.
We have a long, long history of doing fracturing in Michigan. What I will tell you is the natural gas producers, we're not a natural gas producer, but the natural gas producers definitely have high standards for the safety, and they've learned a lot on the safest way to fracture. But most of that is more efficient in places outside of Michigan. Most of the high volume, very reliable fracturing and access to shale gas is happening outside of Michigan. But because of our pipelines and our storage, we're able to purchase that abundant fuel, abundant natural gas in the summer when it's cheap, and bring it into Michigan and then store it so that we can pull it out during this part of the season. But definitely there's been a ton of work done on the safety standards for fracturing, and those gas producers continue to improve in their ability to do that safely.
Patty, we've talked a lot about some very good and effective, innovative programs. As Consumers Energy looks to 2014 and 2015, what are a couple of challenges that face your company?
I think the challenge is that we make sure that we're really continuing to improve our customer service. We have doubled down on our commitment to serving customers and using technology to serve customers really well. So, for example, we had the big ice storm back in December that affected hundreds of thousands of our customers. And it was the first major ice storm where we had our outage map. We had our mobile devices where people could report their outages. They could communicate with us in a much more high-tech way. We had 19 million hits on our website during that storm. 19 million. We only have 2 million customers, right? I think I might have been a million of them, though, because I was checking on the status of things from home. But we really worked hard to make sure that technology enables good communication for customers, because not only do they want their power restored, they want to know when it's going to be restored. Is there a crew assigned to my job? Where are we? What's the status? And so we can really communicate better using technology. So I think that's a big opportunity for us, learning how to let technology serve our customers even better. We're good at keeping the lights on, and we're good at keeping the gas flowing. How we do that less expensively and how we do that with better customer communication is sort of our next horizon.
And my final question, and you are the vice president for customer experience, but do you find that the expectations of some of your younger customers with respect to social media and things of that nature are much higher and much different than maybe some of your more traditional customers like myself or like my great producer, Russ White?
Absolutely. You know, we really, in fact, we've segmented our customers to know their preferences, and some customers definitely want to communicate with us through Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and we have a whole team who manages that. But we also have customers who still want their bill insert. And so the challenge for us is figuring out how to customize communication, customize. Some people want to pay their bill at a direct payment office. Some people want to pay it online. Some people want to talk to a customer service rep. Some people want to do that without ever talking to anyone. So being able to deliver the customer experience that each individual customer wants is a really great challenge that we're tackling and learning and working with our customers to make sure that we're communicating and working with them, providing them the tools and the services that they need the way they want them.
We talk about this a lot in the media, but you're talking about relationship marketing and relationship communication.
Yeah, we think of ourselves, you know, I'll just remind everybody, all your listeners, that Consumers Energy is not a great big conglomerate. We're a Michigan-based company made up of your friends, your family, your neighbors. Maybe each of you know someone who works at Consumers Energy. It is about relationships. And when you're going to serve customers for 126 years, we've made a promise to the people of Michigan. And those relationships are what help us fulfill that promise and make sure we're fulfilling the energy needs of the people of Michigan the way that the people of Michigan want their energy needs fulfilled.
And what a great message to conclude a great interview. I've been talking with Patty Poppe. She's the Vice President for Customer Experience, Rates, and Regulations for our good friends at Consumers Energy. Patty, thank you so much for being on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Great. Thanks for having me, Kirk.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
MLive Media Group is a Greening of the Great Lakes partner. To read Kirk's blog and to hear our show archives, please visit mlive.com/environment.
Please find us on Facebook by searching for Greening of the Great Lakes and follow us on Twitter at Green Michigan.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to a 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
This is MSU Today with Russ White on AM 870 WKAR.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome Paul W. Smith back to the MSU Today microphones. Paul, as Dick Hafner would say when he introduces you each morning, the Hall of Fame voice of mornings on WJR. Welcome back to the show.
Russ, Green and White, White, I'm telling you, I can't believe you're up that early, because he does that at like 5:35, 5:37 when he first throws it to me. God bless you for being up so early. Or maybe you hadn't gone to bed yet.
No, I'm an early bird, but then let's start there, Paul. Congratulations on the Hall of Fame. Talk about what that honor means to you.
Well, it was completely unexpected. I've heard of it before, but I didn't know anything about it. And the funny thing is, I get a text early in the morning on my phone, and from all people, it's the CEO of Cumulus Media, Cumulus Broadcasting, Lou Dickey, and it said, "Congratulations, Paul. We're so proud of you." And I thought, oh boy. You know, he has a lot of employees, 500, 600, 700 radio stations. Somehow I got a text meant for somebody else because I have no idea what he's talking about, which I had to fess up to. I couldn't even fake it. I said, Mr. Dickey, I appreciate that, but I think this probably was supposed to go to someone else. And he said, no, he wrote back, you've been inducted. You're an inductee, or however he worded it, into the National Radio Hall of Fame. And I went, how's that possible? I mean, I didn't know anything about it. Then I went through some of my messages from like months before. I have a – if you're waiting for a call from me, I apologize. It takes me a long time, but I eventually get back. But I'm going through these – and like from 3 months before, somebody from Chicago had called me. As it turns out, it was them to tell me that I was going into this hall, and I didn't know. And it became public and announced. And in November, we had a fabulous event in Chicago at the Museum of Broadcast History, or whatever I think they call it. And Larry King was the MC, and it was just it was a lot of fun. It was an honor.
And Paul, so pleased to learn that you've signed a 7-year deal with Cumulus to stay on mornings at WJR. Just great news.
Well, you know, that's a big deal in any business, but in our business especially, Russ, and since you used to be at WJR and you know the radio and television business intimately, that doesn't happen very often. Contracts are a year, maybe 3 years. I've even heard of 5. But when they put forward a 7-year contract, I mean a real 7-year, no-cut contract, I was stunned and humbled and frankly happy, because I don't like to think about where I'm going next or what I'm doing next. I'm committed to Detroit, committed to WJR, and I want to work there as long as I possibly can.
Paul, what about this beloved medium of ours, radio, as the world races towards more digital ways of getting the information out there? Do you worry about radio, or what's the future for it, do you think?
I'm certainly concerned. I've been doing this now 45 years, in and out of WJR for over 30 years, but back about 18 now, full-time for the morning show. But I used to fill in for JP, used to do the travel show, syndicated travel show, used to do the Focus show from around the country, actually. And I'm committed to this kind of radio. I've had other opportunities to do other kinds of radio and such. And I'm more concerned for music stations, for example, because providing music is getting harder and harder to do, because people can access exactly what they want to hear, exactly when they want to hear it. That's not the case with talk radio. And I will always believe, as I always have, that a city the size of Detroit, a larger city, will always want to wake up hearing things very specific to their city. People have said, why don't you get syndicated? That's not what that morning show is about. Our morning show is about Michigan, and very, very specifically about Detroit and the surrounding area. Of course, Northwest Ohio, Southeast Michigan, all of that is important. But I believe that, and hope and pray, and knock on for Micah, a reasonable facsimile of wood, I believe that that's going to be around for a long time, hopefully long after I'm gone.
What about the state of WJR as it moves forward in this world we're talking about?
Well, you know, for a long time, WJR was owned by Cap Cities Communications. And if you're owned by one company for a very long time, it's a pretty comfortable situation, because they don't have a lot of long-term debt and all of that. Then, of course, Cap Cities bought ABC, which was the mouse that roared. ABC was much bigger, but Cap Cities was much more profitable. They bought ABC. Then that got the attention of the Walt Disney Company. The Walt Disney Company bought then what was Cap Cities ABC, and they really had an eye, wisely, Michael Eisner back then, on ESPN, which is a cash cow and continues to be today. So then they looked at what they had, and they thought, well, we want to keep ESPN. We don't really need this, and we don't need that. And one of the things they didn't need was radio and individual stations, of which there were many very, very good ones, including WJR, real heritage, great radio stations. So then we were bought by Citadel, and it was a big mouthful for them, and at a bad time in the economy, and they had struggles and either went into bankruptcy or touched on the edge of it, however it came through. And it's always interesting to see the guys in charge of the company somehow, when we're all suffering, walk away with millions of dollars. But be that as it may, I don't mean to do my radio show here, be that as it may, now owned by a company that is very familiar with WJR, because the guys that are running the company, Lou Dickey, the CEO, his brother John Dickey is a co-COO, are very familiar with WJR because they grew up in Toledo, Ohio, working for their dad, now the late Lou Dickey, who just passed away this past Thanksgiving. They know WJR. They respect WJR. And believe me when I tell you, that's a lucky break for all of us, because somebody who didn't know WJR and its heritage and its importance in the state, in the community, might have tried to mess with it. You know, everybody wants to fix everything. In this case, we just don't want them to break it, and I am certain that they won't break it.
The Hall of Fame voice of mornings on WJR, Paul W. Smith with me on MSU Today. Paul, what about the beloved city of Detroit, where WJR has resided for its entire existence? Certainly having some troubles. What, in your mind, is the state and future of it?
I'd like to think we've been through the worst of it. Now, that's not that we're out of the worst of it, but this is a part of the worst of it going into the bankruptcy circumstance and situation. There's going to be more pain and suffering. It's inevitable. But I'd like to think that we've turned the corner that I thought we would much sooner, so long ago. When I came back home, when JP died in 19, he died in like 95. I didn't come back till about 11 months later. But I had been through a resurgence in a city, in the city of brotherly love in Philadelphia. They hit rock bottom. They didn't go bankrupt, but they hit rock bottom. And I watched them come back. And I had full expectation that that's what we were going to do in Detroit. It has taken a lot longer than I ever would have expected. But I really believe with this governor, Rick Snyder, with this mayor, Mike Duggan, with his new city council, and with certainly all of the people that are helping out from the business side of things, not waiting around for government money and government intervention, but taking things, the problems into their own hands and fixing them. And I don't want to start naming people because there's so many to name. You know the names of those people. They're investing in the city of Detroit. And I think, hope, pray, that we're on our way, really on our way this time, to a much better day in Detroit, which is therefore good for the great state of Michigan.
And Paul W., what's your advice for the young people today who may want to get into radio or media of some sort?
You know, I have friends in the business who tell me that they can't tell anybody to go into the business now. I would hate to ever take somebody's dream and dash it along the rocks. I will say to anyone wanting to do anything, that no matter what, you have to get your higher education, whether it's a trade school or a community college or a university. I did both. So you have to get your education while you're following your dream. Keep dreaming big. Keep working toward that dream. And the harder you work, just like for me, the harder I work, the luckier I get. It can happen. I have no idea what the future of broadcasting as we know it is. But Russ White, you started this conversation talking about all the different digital ways of getting information and entertainment. I don't know what that will mean for this business years from now. I would tell them, for example, not to go into the buggy whip business, because that business went really bad when they started those, you know, cars.
Paul, your thoughts on this wonderful friendship and partnership that MSU and WJR enjoy?
Well, it's an extra special feeling for me, and it goes back many, many years. I'm a proud graduate of the University of Michigan. I felt that was a very big deal for me. I couldn't get in today, but back then when I was able to, it was a wonderful honor, and I'm proud of that. I am proud of Michigan State and everything that the Spartans represent. We used to be the broadcaster for Michigan. That made me very happy, being a grad. We then became the broadcaster for Michigan State, and that's worked out very, very well. And I root for the Spartans. They're great partners. Luana Simon couldn't be better as a president of a university, and Roy and the whole team there, Mark Hollis. I don't want to go through, and if I start naming everybody, but my point is, it's a wonderful relationship. It's a wonderful business relationship, and more than that. And we consider ourselves great friends. And, you know, people give me sometimes a hard time, but mostly they don't. They understand. You go to University of Michigan, you're going to root for University of Michigan, even if your radio station is the official broadcaster of Michigan State. I support Michigan State, as you well know, in every game other than the ones they play Michigan, and in every other even more important way. When you look at the university research corridor and Michigan State and Wayne State, and so many other ways that Michigan State is such a good community leader and partner. Remember, there was a time Michigan State was not that well represented in the Detroit area. I'd like to think that this relationship between WJR and Michigan State has helped both of us tremendously.
Lastly, Paul, and you're intimately close with all of your listeners, but is there something you'd like us to know about kind of what makes you tick?
I really, really, really don't like getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And that's the truth. I just don't. And no, people come up to me and say, well, you're used to this now, aren't you? I will never, ever, never say never, but I will never, ever, quote unquote, get used to getting up at 4 in the morning because I'm a nighttime guy. And frankly, I it's my fault. I don't get enough sleep, and I don't recommend that for anyone. And I know that we're a society of sleep-deprived people, but I'm really at that edge of three and a half hours of sleep every night, and that's just plain stupid. Don't do as I do. Get some sleep.
Paul, thanks so much for joining us again on MSU Today.
It was my pleasure, Russ, and I'm glad you're so good at this. I didn't even fall asleep or nap during the whole interview. Thank you for that.
Paul W. Smith, as Dick Hafner would say every morning, is the Hall of Fame voice of mornings on WJR. And keep up with Paul and all he does at WJR.com. And I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. You know, we live in a time where people just don't join things anymore. So why are so many Spartans joining the MSU Alumni Association? Well, perhaps it's our world-class alumni enrichment team, constantly stretching Spartan minds and supercharging Spartan careers. Or perhaps it's our Spartan pipeline, which connects you to trusted friends wherever your adventures may take you. The MSU Alumni Association is dedicated to adding Spartan value to your Spartan life. Whatever it is that may be keeping you up at night, we can connect you with a fellow Spartan who can help. We truly live in a world where who you know is just as important as what you know. And joining the MSU Alumni Association can help you build the relationships you need for success on the job and in every corner of your Spartan life. That's why more and more Spartans are joining the MSU Alumni Association. Activate your membership right now at alumni.msu.edu.
Doug Bueller leads MSU Ag Bio Research.
MSU Ag Bio Research is really located strategically within Michigan State University, and we concentrate on research in agriculture, natural resources, and energy.
MSU Ag Bio Research is changing the face of science.
Our mission really is wise use of the resources, both human and natural resources, and also to protect the productivity and profitability of our natural resource and agricultural systems.
More than 300 scientists from six MSU colleges are leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
Well, I think the most important thing we do is to continue to try to develop production systems that can put safe food on our plates, but also protect the environment and also a situation where the producers can make a good living and protect their resources at the same time.
MSU Ag Bio Research, leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
This is MSU Today with Russ White on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.